Okay, so first of all, of course, thank you to Dr. Mohan and Naka for the invitation to attend the meeting. Is the microphone working? Can you hear me? Okay, yes, so thank you, Dr. Mohan and Naka, for the invitation to come and speak at the meeting. Dr. Mohan asked me to talk about perhaps some of the more general principles of disease emergence, that is, why and how. Why do we keep seeing these new disease emergence events, and how do they happen? So I thought what I would do is at least make you feel that you're not alone. The issue of emerging diseases is one that is of serious concern to many people around the world, both with respect to human health and animal health and plant health, for that matter, as well as people involved in aquaculture and fisheries. In fact, in human health, emerging diseases have obtained the name EID, or emerging infectious diseases. So they're known as EIDs. And they're defined essentially as any disease that's either first emerged or is increasing significantly in its geographic distribution over the last 20 years. In fact, these EIDs account for 12% at least of the known human pathogens. They're mostly caused by bacteria and rickettsia, and most of these recorded EIDs are associated with drug resistance. About a quarter of all EIDs are caused by viruses, and of the EIDs that are of major concern, most of them, or at least 60% of them, are what we call zoonotic. And that means that they're human diseases that are obtained from animals. And they may not cause disease in animals, but when they infect humans, they can cause disease. And most of those originate from wildlife. So not from domestic animals like cattle or sheep or pigs, but more commonly from wild animals that move into the human, the pathogens move into the human population. And many of them, in fact, are also transmitted by biting insects. They're vector-borne or mosquito-transmitted diseases. So if we look around the world, you'll see what are classified as EIDs of human concern, and it's a major, major global problem. Many of these EIDs you'll be very familiar with, of course, SARS, the H5N1 influenza, that there's serious concern that this virus, which comes from chickens and birds, may infect humans, which it can, but if it could then move to the next stage and be transmitted from one human to another human, we would have a really, really big international problem. Nipah and Hendra viruses, viruses that come out of bats, Lassa fever, HIV, of course, is one that we all know about that emerged as a major problem in the 1980s, and so on. Yellow fever, dengue, anthrax. So there are many of these emerging infectious diseases that people in the medical community and in the animal health community are trying to deal with on a daily basis. And if we think, for example, of how these occur, because it might help us understand the sort of problems that we're facing in aquaculture. So one that you will all be very familiar with, and many of you may have experienced the disruption that was caused by the emergence of SARS. And that viral disease emerged in China, in Guangdong province, in 2002. Over a period of only 6 months, it spread to 37 countries. It's estimated that the economic impact of that spread was in excess of $20 billion. It caused 916 deaths, and there were over 8,000 cases of infection. So that case fatality rate was relatively high, around about 10%. That's a virus that emerged from wildlife. It probably, very likely, is a virus that infects bats as a result of trading of bats and trading of civets in markets. The virus moved out of the bats and infected civets, civet cats. Civet cats had become a food of some interest in China. People were then exposed to eating the civet cats and exposed in the markets to live civet cats, and it was through that process that people became infected. As the virus moved out of the bats into the cats, civets, and then into humans, the virus slowly changed until it changed enough that it could multiply in the humans, and then it spread from human to human. So we were able to completely eliminate SARS from the human population by isolating the cases, because it was actually quite a rare event. But it was a rare event caused by that alignment of circumstances and in some changes in social behaviour. Thinking of another example of an infectious disease that's quite important at this time is a virus called chikungunya. Now, this is a virus that's actually been known for some time. It's a virus that was transmitted by the mosquito Aedes aegypti, and this is a mosquito you may know because it's the mosquito that transmits the dengue virus. Aedes aegypti is a mosquito that lives primarily in urban regions. It breeds in fresh water, normally rainwater, in things like upturned tyres. And so they're the normal breeding sites, and you usually only find dengue in urban or very, very densely populated rural areas. Well, what happened in this case of this virus, in Africa, in which it had been known since 1952, in 2005, it spread out of Africa to French Reunion Island, and it infected over nearly a quarter of a million people in Reunion Island and caused over 200 deaths. It's now moved into India. There's been over a million cases of chikungunya in India. And what's happened in this case is that through a single amino acid mutation in the glycoprotein on the surface of the virus, it's a single alanine to valine change at amino acid 226, this virus was able to now replicate in a different mosquito species and replicate very, very efficiently. And that other mosquito species is Aedes albopictus. And Aedes albopictus doesn't occur only in cities. Aedes albopictus occurs in many, many ecological settings. And it's also a mosquito that is increasing in global distribution. So with the mosquito, the virus has moved. And with this very efficient replication in a mosquito that has a wider distribution, this has become an incredibly important emerging disease, actually throughout Asia, South Asia, and also into Italy. So turning to shrimp, this is, as you know, our history of disease emergence. Don will probably object to seeing IHHNV sitting over Hawaii there in 1981, but we have seen regularly the emergence of new infectious diseases that have, many of them, have had devastating effects on the shrimp farming industry. And when we look at the impacts on production, they're very clear. The one that we always recognise, of course, is white spot syndrome virus. But each of these pathogens in one way or another has had a very significant impact on productivity. So coming to the question of why, does this happen? What I'd encourage you to do is think about pathogens, about viruses and other pathogens, as a natural element of the ecosystem. In fact, pathogens in the process of infection don't necessarily have to cause disease. In many cases, it may be just fine for the pathogen to infect and be transmitted. And if its transmission isn't dependent on the generation of clinical disease, then there's no reason for the pathogen to do that. It may do it as an unintended consequence, but there's no reason in the case of many pathogens to create disease simply to survive. So what tends to happen over long periods of time is that, and in fact it may be that killing the host is something that is not very good for the pathogen, because if it kills too many of the host, then the pathogen's got nowhere to go. So in many cases, what happens with pathogens over a long period of time is they establish a friendly relationship with the host. They infect, they don't do any damage, they're efficiently transmitted, the host gets on with things, the pathogen gets on with things, and everything's okay. So in associations that have a very long history, particularly in evolution, where there's a natural association of a pathogen with a host, it's usually an association that's non-pathogenic. But then we come along and we change things. We affect the environment, we affect things that can disrupt this association between the pathogen and the host. And it's that disturbance in the ecology of disease that is at the heart of most disease emergence events. So if we think about it in these terms, and this is a diagram I'm sure that many of you have seen before, the host, the pathogen, environment, and it's when you get a coincidence of circumstances, we see the emergence of disease. So what can create those circumstances? There are things in which the pathogen itself can be involved in influencing that process. So when we think about pathogen, we've got to take into account things like, in particularly RNA viruses, what's called quasi-species variation, that is the natural genetic variation that occurs within the pathogen. The pathogen can undergo things like genetic recombination. We can see slight changes in the adaptation of a pathogen as it moves from one host to another host or vector. There can be issues of tissue tropism. There can be pathogens that simply by chance become more virulent and begin to spread with increased virulence. And we've got issues around latency and persistence. If we think about the host influences, there's a concept that I'll talk about a little bit more called spillover. And that is that there may be interactions between different hosts that allow a virus that naturally infects one host to begin to infect another host. There may be that there are intermediary hosts in the process in which a pathogen that naturally infects one host moves across another host into another, like the civet cat in the case of SARS. We need to be thinking about the immune response, the possibility that hosts may be immunodeficient, leading to the emergence of pathogens that don't normally cause disease, and so on. But perhaps the issue here that is of most relevance to us is what we would call anthropogenic and geophysical influences. That is, the things that we do, not the host and not the pathogen, but the things that we do to upset this imbalance. And the major drivers of those sorts of things that affect on human infectious diseases have been identified as globalization, urbanization, so changing our dynamic with the environment, the changes in land use, changes in agricultural practices, cultural changes, and even human conflict. Wars and conflict are a very well-known and common source of new emerging diseases. And then we also have this very difficult one, geophysical influences, which we might say is anthropogenic anyway, that is, if human beings are responsible for climate change. Climate change, climate variability, so not only that climate is changing, but it's becoming more variable, and also that climate change is leading to extreme weather events, and those extreme weather events in themselves can lead to changes in the balance of pathogen and host. So if we think about shrimp now again, we're talking about ecological change on a massive scale. 2 million hectares of shrimp ponds around the world, 220 different farm species with respect to aquaculture in general, terrestrial ponds, sea cages, taking animals out of their natural environment, putting them into an unnatural environment. We use artificial or alternative feeds. We have completely changed patterns of trade. We've seen 28,000 P. vanhamii broodstock p- per month moving into Asia some years ago when Vanamai was establishing from the Western Hemisphere. And we see over 4.5 million tons of shrimp product traded annually. So all of these things are dynamics that are affecting the conditions that can impact on the potential for the emergence and subsequent spread of disease. So we have to conclude from that there's no doubt that aquaculture is important. It's an important contributor to socioeconomic development, and it's contributing very significantly to international trade and prosperity around the world. That's undeniable. But we also have to understand that aquaculture practices, as a new emerging industry, as a very dynamic industry around the world, creates an ideal environment for the emergence and spread of pathogens. So we're culturing under unnatural conditions, we're often stocking in high density, so if a pathogen emerges, it's like being in a big city where there's lots of options for it to be transmitted very rapidly. We often find that animals may be under stressed conditions, so that can further create a situation that results in the emergence of disease. And then we have a trade, I've said unregulated, I know that's improving, but we have the issue of appropriate regulation of trade in aquatic animals and aquatic animal products. So if we think now about EIDs or emerging pathogens, can we categorise them? Well, the way I look at it, and we have probably got some reasonable examples of that here in shrimp aquaculture, we can think about the emergence of a pathogen that's actually a natural infection of shrimp. And because of certain circumstances that may be stress or changes in salinity or changes in weather conditions, we see the emergence of a disease. And that may not normally happen when the shrimp are in their natural environment, but when you bring them into an aquaculture environment, disease may be a problem. And I suggest that perhaps MBV and YHV maybe fall into that category. I've worked on YHV for a very long time, and I'm not absolutely convinced myself it's a natural shrimp pathogen, at least a monodon pathogen, but it's certainly very closely related to many viruses that do mostly infect monodon. Another way in which this can happen is what we call spillover, and that is that a pathogen that infects one host can spill over to infect another host. And in this case, that means that shrimp get the infection from another animal. And again, we don't know enough about the origins of many of the shrimp viruses, but on the basis of the way in which they've emerged and the very, very limited location in which events originally happened, you would say that TSV, WSSV and IMNV probably fall into this sort of category. And the third category of EID, and this is perhaps more pertinent to the way in which we're looking at human disease, is viruses that are a natural infection, but what's actually happening is that they're increasing in geographic distribution, either through trade or through climate change or through some other mechanism. And given that we've known about the Macrobacterium rosenbergii notovirus for quite some time, this is the virus that I think Tim referred to earlier, we might perhaps consider that that's a virus that's increasing in geographic distribution rather than something that's emerged relatively recently. So those that emerge in the natural host and are non-pathogenic are probably, as I said, because of a long period of adaptation to that particular situation. They're transmitted and replicate very efficiently without the development of disease. In this case, we see the emergence of disease. We can see the emergence of the disease as a result in a change in the pathogen. In other words, that pathogen mutates or changes or acquires some form of increased virulence to then result in disease. We can see a change in the environment, so the host becomes stressed, the shrimp becomes stressed, and that results in disease. Or we could see a change in the host itself, and that might be because we've actually selected for animals that are more susceptible to a particular pathogen. It may be that we cause them to be immunodeficient in some way, or it may be that they obtain a concurrent infection that allows a normally non-pathogenic pathogen or non-pathogenic agent to become pathogenic. If we think about the second category, so diseases that emerge by spillover, and once again, these animals would very, very commonly are not pathogenic in the natural host. And in that case, in veterinary terms at least, we call the natural host a reservoir. In other words, it's a source of infection without causing disease that if it spills over, if you can imagine a reservoir of water spilling over, it can spill over to infect another host and cause disease. So what can cause that process to happen? Well, one factor that sort of has two sides is increased proximity. That is, the increased proximity of the new host to the old host. So in this case, it could mean that we move shrimp into an environment in which there is a reservoir and in which there's a virus that they've never seen before, but they become exposed to it. And it jumps across and it infects the shrimp. It can mean that we move into a new environment where that happens, or it can mean that we actually introduce the reservoir to the shrimp, and that could be in the form of a new feed, a live feed that contains a pathogen that it's now being exposed to the shrimp. It may be that this process occurs as a result of increased frequency. That is, the exposure may have been occurring, but it's not been occurring often enough for this unusual rare event of adaptation to the new host to occur. But we increase the frequency of exposure, increasing the likelihood that that genetic change or that shift can happen and it jumps over. There may be that there's a genetic change in the pathogen that's infecting the reservoir host that allows it to easily jump. So it can be a genetic change. And it may be that we cause the pathogen in the reservoir to greatly amplify in numbers because for some reason the reservoir becomes stressed. So that great increase in number of the pathogen gives it a bigger opportunity to jump into a new host. And I think one of the things that we need to bear in mind here is that this idea of spillover, that is of a pathogen or a virus jumping from one host to another, to a new host, is something that we do know occurs most likely between most closely related species. So, for example, we don't know of any case of an invertebrate virus that infects man. That is, it normally infects an invertebrate, but it's changed to infect humans. We don't know that that's ever happened. We don't know of any plant virus that's actually changed to jump into humans. What we do know is if you look at these jumps, the more closely related the species are, the more chance there is for it to jump. And that makes sense because it has to have all of the genetic characteristics and expressed protein characteristics that will allow it to get by well. So that, I think, has implications for us when we're thinking about co-cultivation and so on. So for this spillover to occur, it takes a number of different steps. The first is that you need the opportunity for exposure, and then once exposed, the infection actually has to establish. Now, infection of a single shrimp with a virus that's come from somewhere else isn't enough. That shrimp has to be infected, but it also has to be able to transmit the infection to a new shrimp to get things moving along the way. And in the process of transmission beginning to happen, it will adapt to the point that it can then replicate very efficiently in the new host. And that results to the spread of infection. So there are actually several steps along the way that have to happen for this process to occur. And if we'd like to think about the third category, that is increasing distribution. I think we can probably just think about this in any case in relation to the spread of infection. And some of these things are associated with human factors, and some of them associated with environmental factors, as we've discussed previously. So how can we reduce the impact? This is telling us that it is actually a natural process, that most of it is being caused by us, but we have to. We've got to get on with life. We've got to get on with business. We've got to get on with growing our industry. But as a consequence of that, we can expect that we're going to have some issues. Of course, the most important element of this relates to early detection and our response. And I think the NACA director and Dr. Mohan mentioned this previously. How can we do that better? How can we be better organised? Certainly the aquatic animal health reporting and the international cooperation and the seriousness, the skills, many of these things have improved immensely since I first became involved in this some 15 years ago. But we do still have to get better, because when this does occur, the best thing we can do is contain it at the earliest possible stage. So early detection and response are extremely important. But where we're going in the future here is to say, well, we know these events occur. Can we be better at predicting where hotspots or high-risk situations might be? Because if we can stop the events from occurring at all, that's much more cost-effective than having to deal with the consequences after they occur. Now, that might seem fairly challenging, but I'd suggest you think about it in terms of cancer. We know that certain cancers will occur with a particular rate in the population, but we don't know who and when they're going to occur. But we're getting better at that. We're getting better at predicting the types of risk factors, the types of situations that might lead to the high risk of human cancer. So where we're moving to with the disease prediction and prevention is to think about how we can be better at understanding the processes sufficiently to predict and prevent, not react. How can we do that? So to give you some examples, it helps to study, to have case studies. So it helps to understand what's happened in the past with EIDs, to really study and understand that process so we can learn from it and improve the way in which we can deal with those similar types of events in the future. And that sort of approach, of course, has led to the identification of bats in particular as high-risk animals for us to engage with, because they do carry not only SARS, but they carry things like Ebola virus, and they carry rabies virus and the Hendra and the Nipah virus. So bats, we have to be very careful about our engagement with bats. So we've learnt that. There are many pathogens that are in reference collections around the world that have been collected for one reason or another, or many, many agents, and they've been poorly characterised. People just haven't had time or resources to deal with them. That's beginning to change with high-throughput sequencing, and we can now begin to work through reference collections and better characterise some of these things that we already know about but perhaps don't understand that they either already cause or may be a risk of disease. We can do experimental studies to better understand the host-pathogen interface and the evolution of the relationship between pathogen and host. And so understand the process of adaptation and the transmission of infection. We now have massive computing capabilities that's being applied to making enormous predictions about weather events. We all know that weather forecasting, for those of us who live in parts of the world where weather changes actually far more than it does in most of Asia, we know that weather forecasting is much better than it used to be. And that's because of modellers and sensors and ways in which people are able to sense the environment and model various circumstances. So my group is working with those sort of people to try to better understand particular emerging infectious diseases at the landscape level. So we can apply high-throughput genome sequencing technologies to sequence many, many viruses across the landscape, to map high-density genetic markers in the host, to bring in weather, to bring in landscape factors and so on, to better understand the whole ecology and where the hotspots might be. And we can use correlative studies using that sort of data to identify those hotspots. So implications for shrimp health management. Obviously, what we need to be doing is avoiding very high-risk circumstances. And those, I think, we know about already. Live feeds. We've known for a long time that it's a very risky thing to be using live feed, particularly new species, particularly new crustacean or new invertebrate species. They have to be dealt with very carefully because they very likely will carry pathogens. And those pathogens, we may be giving the pathogen a perfect opportunity to jump, spill over into a new host. We need to be careful about co-cultivation because that's another circumstance. Although I've talked to people who have felt that they're recreating the natural environment by putting all of these species together in a single pond, and this is more natural. Well, it is sort of a proxy for the natural situation, but what you may be doing is putting together species that normally don't ever meet each other, and one of them may carry a virus that can jump across to the other. So when we co-cultivate, and particularly closely related species, and I think, you know, we've seen Monodon vanimae, great opportunity for viruses to jump from one to the other, very closely related. So when we think co-cultivation, we've got to be very careful about not creating a circumstances for spillover. Of course, we need to employ pathogen exclusion practices, and that's something that the industry has been working towards for a very long time. We need to be employing stress reduction practices so that if there are viruses or pathogens present, we don't stress the shrimp to allow them to replicate more effectively. We need to be applying disease containment practices to prevent the spread. And of course, we need to be applying responsible trading practices. So to conclude then, look, new diseases continue to emerge and they will continue to emerge. They'll continue to spread into new areas and we'll continue to see losses, probably very significant losses on production. We know that the losses are not only affecting profits, but they're also having environmental impacts through secondary consequences, such as the use of chemicals, the use of antibiotics, and so on. We know that industry would like technological solutions to many of these issues that I'm talking about, simply a quick fix technology, and there may be some useful technology solutions, but I think in the end it's really coming down to the way in which our policies, practices and our behaviours and our alertness are applied to the situation. Responsible practices, understanding the risks, having the industry understand that these things can occur, and if they undertake high-risk practices, they will only encourage more and more disease emergence events. And with that, I'd like to thank you.